Steve, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and it's Wendy. Welcome to the show. Because it is September 11th, I think we'd be cheating ourselves if we didn't kind of address the issues of what took place 17 years ago. 17 years ago today, which is amazing as I think about it. It's one of those things, and I've told you this before, Wendy, there are certain events in your life that seem like they happened 1,000 years ago, but they also seem like they happened a week ago.
Yep.
You know?
September 11th, 2001, 7:45 a.m. Chicago time, a plane hits the World Trade Center. Many people, I know I thought this, oh, look at this small plane that hit the World Trade Center. And then 18 minutes later, a second plane came in and hit the other tower, and that's when we knew we were under attack.
Yep.
And we're going to talk to Tom Makaitis right now, professor of history at DePaul University, a terrorism expert. Tom, I hate you can't say happy 9/11, but welcome to 9/11.
Hello, how are you doing?
It's just one of those days that truly we didn't know what to do on today, but it's one of those days that people still want to talk about. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, there are certain events. They don't necessarily change the course of history, but they become, you know, the defining moments in our lives. We talk about time fixing, the ability everybody knows exactly where they were when they realized what was occurring. So, yeah, there's no question. And how we live our lives has to some degree changed as a result of 9/11 in ways that, you know, when I always think about it, it's sort of sobering to think that my freshman students this year have no real memory of the event. It's already history for them.
And do you cover that? Because I know there was quite some time in the elementary school that my kids, they kind of mentioned it, but it was not really discussed in the curriculum.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, I was very active, obviously, in covering 9/11 when it occurred. But the attitude of a lot of parents was, let's not frighten our kids and not talk about it. And I spoke at my son's junior high school, and I asked, how many of you are afraid to travel? And all these hands shot up. And the message of that is, if you don't talk to your kids about even things that are this upsetting, then what they pick up is fear, and they pick up anxiety, and that's actually that's less constructive. I think to some degree, though, covering it at least maybe fading a bit. You know, we're getting 17, 18, 20 will probably be a big one, but at some point, you know, this will be a footnote in history.
You know, Tom, that's an interesting thing you say, because I've been thinking about this. If you are younger than, I mean, we, older than 30, you know, it's seared in our minds and we experienced it. But if you now are what, younger than 30 years old, you would have been 13 at the time. It's something that you've only heard about during your life. It's less something that you've experienced. Yeah. So it's our country's changing in that way.
And you also take for granted things that were an adjustment for us. I mean, like all of us can remember when you could walk your loved one all the way to the gate and say goodbye as they stepped on the plane, quite literally. Now, of course, that's impossible. And this has just simply become the new normal for us. And we don't really, in some ways that's healthy. We don't really get twitched out about it. I mean, remember that first year we were going from orange to yellow and back and forth in the alerts, and all we were doing was driving ourselves crazy.
Yeah.
Tom, go back with us 17 years ago, right after the second plane hit the towers. There was so much speculation as to exactly what was going on. Nobody knew exactly what was going on, and nobody knew exactly who was responsible. And as you watch television, you had a lot of theories being thrown out there. When did we realize exactly who was responsible?
That's interesting you mentioned. Wendy mentioned the kid, you know, it's a small, that's exactly what happened with me. I was taking my son to school, and he goes, Dad, it must be a terrorist attack. He knows what I do. And he was about, you know, 11 or 12. And I said, no, it's some poor person rammed his Piper Cub into it. And as soon as I saw the second plane, we knew it was a terrorist attack. I think pretty quickly it was possible to connect the dots to say, wait a second, there was the embassy bombing, there's been a threat from Al-Qaeda since, you know, the fatwa in 96 and again in 98. That they put together pretty quickly and determined who was responsible.
That moment, that second plane hit, is when everything changed. You just felt like you were punched in the stomach. The coverage was wall to wall. I remember watching the footage because, as Justin Kaufman mentioned earlier, there was no social media. There was no Twitter. So we were just trying to consume everything we could. And there were so many unanswered questions. But I'll never forget the footage they had, and they kept showing of people jumping off that building. I'll never forget that. Mm.
Me either. I got home, realized second plane, and immediately got phone calls, went into WGN, and didn't come back for 13 hours. And exactly right. They were holding hands, jumping out the window, and none of us could, to avoid burning to death, which is a more horrible way to go. I don't think any of us did that. And yeah, it was constant coverage. And I don't think people realized too, there were no teleprompters. People were literally just going along. I mean, they had them, but they weren't using them. For the most part, it was bringing in people to discuss it and a lot of speculation, trying to make sense of the unthinkable, because this was not supposed to happen to the United States.
Tom, nearly every question I ask you could start with these words, but in retrospect, what could we or should we have seen? Is there anything, were there any red flags, any telltale signs of what was to come?
Yeah, the 9/11 report, you know, had a chapter saying all the indicators were blinking red. But I think what we had was what we call strategic warning, which means, you know, the same with Pearl Harbor. It's like, okay, the Japanese are planning an attack somewhere in the Pacific. You know, it's a big place. If you go back, you could reconnect the dots and say, okay, now I see that there's a pattern there. But that pattern sometimes doesn't become clear. Till afterwards, any of us who have had family members with a substance abuse issue, part of when you get, you know, when they get help and you get the counseling, will go, oh yeah, my gosh, I didn't realize there were all these warning signs. Now I see. But when you're enmeshed in events and you're enmeshed in the times in which you live, it's not always that clear. And I was asked, you know, was President Bush responsible? No. Could we have done better? Did we need to pay attention? You know, yeah, we did. We missed some things. But then again, it's understandable to some degree how we missed them.
Do you think to some extent, because nothing like that had ever happened to us before, thankfully, that we were... You know where I'm going.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. But you know exactly what I'm saying. The mere fact that nothing even remotely close to that had ever happened to us meant that we weren't looking for it.
Yeah, a lot of security failures, and really failures in life in general, are what we call failures of imagination. In other words, I never imagined it could happen here. And that's a human thing. It's understandable. We get comfortable. We get used to taking our security for granted. And, you know, we'd had devastating attacks, the USS Cole in Aden Harbor. We'd had the attack on the embassy bombings. But those were still overseas. You know, and it didn't occur to us. And even at the time, it was an absurdity of screening. And I remember this. I did, before, doing this, I did a lot of work on the Northern Ireland campaign. So I got used to being screened going overseas. And if I was in the British Isles, I got checked even more just by virtue of their security measure. But, you know, it's like, no, we don't worry about domestic flights because it just doesn't happen here. Obviously, that, you know, was proved tragically incorrect.
I was thinking about that on the way in today. If George W. feels any kind of guilt or anything, it's not his fault. I know it's not. And no one really blamed him. I mean, in the aftermath of 9/11, what was so touching to me is we all came together as a country, and I feel like that's dissipating a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think there was a very strong sense of pulling together and so on. And, you know, it's one thing to say, and again, you go back to the personal example of your life. If you look backwards, we can all say, gee, how come I didn't see this? I could have done this better. Why was I so foolish and this kind of thing? But that's very different to say than that was a major, you know, someone willfully ignored or was just oblivious to what was going on. That isn't the case. They were telling you this morning, it's real interesting, the whole issue of security briefings. Frequently, the president gets a lot of security briefings, but his briefer that morning did not even mention terrorism. So, you know, and they deal with a complicated threat environment. So it's easy to be the armchair quarterback on, you know, Monday morning, but not quite as easy when you're kind of wrapped up in things.
We're talking to Tom Mikitas, professor of history at DePaul University, terrorism expert. We'll continue this conversation in just a little bit. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's 9/11, and we are speaking with Dr. Tom Mikaitis, professor of history at DePaul University, also a terrorism expert. And when we did find out that Al-Qaeda was responsible, which there was a lot of questions, a lot of questions at the very beginning, is Al-Qaeda still working?
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that question because I was asked to write a piece, a short article for an online journal about the what are called the Abbottabad files. At the time Osama bin Laden was killed, we had a bonanza of intelligence information that was picked up. It took some time to translate it. The evidence suggests that even though they've been eclipsed by ISIS, they're still there, and there's some evidence they're actually regrouping. You know, and the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that, you know, it's the ideology that is most pernicious. These groups come and go, but I fully expect there to be an Al-Qaeda 2.0 or an ISIS 2.0 or a something else. Well, that's the bad news. The good news is terrorism is a chronic, persistent problem, much like organized crime. It is not an existential threat, you know, much as the fear is exaggerated. It, you know, I don't see it destroying us in our way of life.
What is, I know this will sound like a strange question, but I seriously mean this. What is the working relationship amongst terrorist groups like those two? Do they just coexist? Do they get along? Are they at odds? How do they feel about each other?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just talking about this briefing I do with a counterterrorism program through the U.S. government, and I was telling the students, foreign students and so on, that in fact, if you take a look, there's a map, the mapping has been done of terrorist attacks since over the last 45 years. Overwhelmingly, they're connected to regional and local conflicts, but they latch on. I mean, Boko Haram in Nigeria is very much involved in a struggle, you know, a north-south struggle within Nigeria, but it has sworn allegiance to the Islamic State. So we go, oh my gosh, international terrorism. You know, Al-Shabaab in Somalia and various other groups are in fact really focused on local power struggles, local issues, but they share a common ideology. So they will cooperate, they may share assets to a limited extent, but it's not the case that all of them are interested in what Al-Qaeda called the far enemy, which is us, who mainly are targeted because we interfere with their efforts to build their Islamic you know, state run by Sharia in Muslim countries primarily. That's why we got attacked on 9/11. Not because they're interested in getting rid of us per se, but they wanted to get us out of what they saw as their sphere of influence.
In your opinion, Tom, could this happen again?
Yeah, it could. I think we have gotten a lot more savvy in terms of, for example, the target hardening. You know, airports are always a worry, but they're less of a worry than they were. But I was on a couple of weeks ago talking about Lollapalooza. Since 2006, when Lashkar-e-Taiba hit Mumbai with a team of 10 people and did, you know, serious damage and killed over 150 people, venues are becoming the new target. The good thing is, for lack of, again, a better, if you want to call it a silver lining, I don't know that it would shock us to the degree that 9/11 did. I think, you know, we've been down the road before. It would not be good, but I think we'd dust ourselves off and recover. The other thing that has to be said, too, and this was a big issue of 9/11, it's a big issue now, is we have to be very, very careful of, you know, condemning large groups of people for the behavior of a few fanatics. That was a real worry after 9/11, you know, an uptick in anti-Muslim activity and so on. And we're seeing that again. That's a concern. You know, right now I'm far more worried about extremism on the far right, the white nationalist movement and so on, than I am about ISIS. I'm actually working on a book on that, on those two threats and putting them in a healthy perspective.
We don't have a lot of time at all, Tom. I'm just curious. After the events of 9/11, there was a fear in the country that this was going to be the new normal, that this could possibly happen a lot more often, and it hasn't. And that's not just because of luck, that because there's a lot of men and women out there who are devoting their lives to stopping this. Who do we thank for that?
Oh, you can thank anybody who has served their country in the military, the police, the FBI, the intelligence community. You can't thank them because they won't identify that that's what they do.
Yeah.
But they certainly deserve the credit. Our international partners are a huge part of it, but it's a group effort. The other is an informed citizenry, you know, and so on. But I have great respect for everybody who's involved in this long struggle. And it's not going to go away, but it's ceasing to be the preoccupation it once was. That's a good thing.
And Bill and I were talking about this off the air. Jules and Gédéon Naudet, two French brothers that were in New York City at the time of September 11th. They made this amazing documentary that I feel like I'm going to watch again tonight. I've seen it several times, but it really is an amazing piece of work, which really hits you right where it hurts.
Yeah, there's some speculation Al-Qaeda hit the towers with a delay between the two flights because they wouldn't be sure of TV coverage. That French crew was there filming something else and got footage we wouldn't otherwise have had.
It's pretty amazing. It's worth a watch. And you can just, I don't know the name of it, but you can Google French Brothers 9/11 documentary and it'll come right up. Thank you so much for remembering this day in history. We really appreciate talking to you, Tom.
Have a nice day.
Thanks, Tom. Tom Makaitis, professor of history at DePaul University and terrorism expert.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. It's 7:20 right here on your AM dial. 9/11 happened 17 years ago. It was 7:45 a.m. Chicago time. I totally remember it. I know you do too, Bill.
Sure.
And there is a text that we would like to share with you. Hi, Bill and Wendy. I remember vividly the day 9/11 happened during the day. I was 4 years old watching the news with my mother. What we thought was just another ordinary day was interrupted by breaking news that cut into the program we were watching. When we saw the news that planes had struck the Twin Towers, my mother was crying uncontrollably. My father was traveling that day, and we were devastated. Luckily, he came home safe and sound. I want to thank all of the heroes, military, first responders, citizens who risked their lives saving as many people as possible during this tragic event. My thoughts and prayers are with everyone that lost a family member on this day. God bless America. Thank you, Eric.
My daughters were the same age. They were 4 years old when this happened 17 years ago, and we were on vacation in Florida, and they kept asking why I keep watching this show, because the news was on, and the footage that they had at the time was extremely limited, but they did just keep showing it over and over and over. And every time the girls would pass by, they'd say, stop watching this show. Why do you keep watching this show?
We forget, and I know you brought it up earlier about there was no Twitter, but we forget about how much communication has changed.
Yeah.
So that morning I was working in the newsroom, of course, and I got a phone call, and it was Senator Durbin. And this was, you know, just an hour or so after, and I'm like, Senator, are you okay? And he said, yes. And I said, where are you? And he said, I'm in the Capitol. He said, what's going on? And I said, he talked about smoke that he saw, and I said, well, they've hit the Pentagon too. And at the time, he wasn't even aware himself, a U.S. senator in the Capitol, that the Pentagon had been hit. He said, we thought it was the State Department. And it's one of those stories where when it happens, I didn't believe it. I ran into him a few years ago, and that was his recollection as well. So many people were tied to the TV stations and the radio stations at the time to let them know, because we just didn't have a way. We didn't have Twitter or Facebook or anything like that.
Do you remember, Steve, how if you were looking at the more traditional networks, the ABCs and NBCs and CBSs and Foxes of the world, whoever their main anchors were, weren't in because it was the morning and your main anchors do the nightly news.
Right.
But I remember everybody scurrying to get in, and some of them reported almost around the clock. They just stayed on, you know, as long as they possibly could.
I remember Tom Brokaw on the Today Show early on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, and Peter Jennings as well. And the story was that Peter Jennings, who'd quit smoking, started smoking after that, and he died of cancer not too long after that.
And I was on my way to work, working in radio that day. My husband and I worked at the same radio station, WCKG, and our boss, Jeff Schwartz, called and said, go home, go pick up your kid at daycare, be home together as a family. And we took him up on that because I have to be honest with you, we were petrified.
Yeah.
And then the same thing, Michael was two at the time, and we were just watching that coverage, and it was the same stuff, and it was people jumping, and he's like, people are jumping.
Yeah.
And it's like, hard to explain.
Couldn't explain it because no one was explaining it to us.
Yeah.
You know? But we are changing as a country. We're getting older, and that's one of the things that interests me, because even though you had a four-year-old who said she remembers distinctly,
yeah.
You know, our experience is very different from someone who's 20 years younger and 25 years younger, and as they get older, the experiences of 9/11 are going to become secondhand, or they're going to become of memory, and it's just interesting to me to see how that changes as the time passes.
But are they? Because everybody talks about the JFK assassination, and I was 6 months old and have no recollection at all. Bill is amazing. He was a minute old.
I was one day old. Right.
And, of course, he remembers everything from that day. But that's something that we haven't forgotten, and this is more catastrophic.
No, I'm not saying we will have forgotten it, but I'm saying our experience of it. Your experience of JFK's assassination was much different from what your parents was.
Oh, true.
Because they felt that gasp when it happened. Or September 11th, there was another texter earlier who said she lived in central Illinois and thought they were coming after her. I mean, that's the impact of terrorism, and that's how that felt, how we kind of allowed ourselves to feel after the next few weeks after that. You know, we all thought there was another attack coming around the corner.
And you were at work, you were here.
Yeah.
Did you have fear? Did you think that Chicago was targeted? Because, boy, that ran through everyone's mind.
I remember being on the river taxi at the time. It's funny because I wasn't aware of the attack at the time, but I remember what a beautiful day it was. That's one of my enduring memories.
It was just like today. Exactly.
Came in and was in the newsroom standing by the monitors, and this is after the first plane had hit. I'm standing next to Orion as the second plane went in, and he, of course, knew airlines more than me, and I'm like, that was a commercial flight, and he said, yeah.
And but it took a moment to process that, you know?
Just the dimensions of it, that right.
Yeah.
And then we had a producer, and I believe his name was Brian. I'm sorry, I don't remember his last name. And we sent him over to Sears Tower because we didn't know what was coming next. And I remember when he was just about to out the door, and I'm like, hey, Brian. And he turned, and I said, look, don't get too close, because we wanted someone over there, but we didn't know if maybe it was there. But, I mean, I'm talking about even in days and weeks and months afterward, we were so fearful of so many things that I mean, and that's the impact of, you know, a successful terror campaign.
Well, we were fearful of coming to the Tribune Tower for weeks.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
Steve,
yeah. But Mary, but that's exactly my point. I mean, do you think that Osama bin Laden or someone sitting overseas or in Afghanistan or wherever is going to pinpoint the Tribune Tower? Probably not.
I'm not a fan of Spike.
Tower, no.
Except
I mean, the Sears
the
Tower,
news,
no. But that's
know.
It. We create all these things. I mean, I went to a county festival in rural Illinois several weeks later, and they said, you know, this is the heart of America. This is a prime target. Well, no one was thinking about that.
Steve, has it ever been determined? I mean... If you were a terrorist group, you certainly had your pick of targets in the United States. So was the World Trade Center chosen because, A, it's in the heart of New York City, and then also it represents the world? Was that their ideal there?
I don't remember that specifically, Bill, but I suspect that was it. You know, and it was the site of an earlier attempt in 93 or 94.
Yes.
So I think that always sort of did stand for that.
It is 9/11. We'll be discussing it throughout the show today. We're going to take a quick break, Tech Tuesday interlude, as we talk about your iPhone and can you sell it back? Because I'm ready to. Mine keeps crapping out on me. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN. Oh, yeah, that music means it's a Tech Tuesday, and CNET senior editor Bridget Carey is with us. Apple is all the rage. I know we speak about Apple all the time, but a big Apple event is coming up tomorrow afternoon. Rumors, speculation. Let's get to the bottom of it, Bridget.
Yeah, the bottom of it is basically going to be goodbye home button. if you look at all the rumors and you put them all together, and usually there's a lot of truth to when you see repeating rumors over and over again. If you look into the crystal ball, it looks like there'll be three new iPhone models, and they're all going to look more or less like that new iPhone 10, which uses face scanning to unlock instead of a fingerprint scanner home button. And they, that way you get more of that front is just a big old screen. And I guess Apple's really trying to make this face scanning technology the future of biometrics.
Will that big screen break more easily?
Oh, you know it.
Yeah.
I mean, Apple's going to say things about how I'm sure technology is a little more durable, but let's be honest, it's more screen to, you know, to break, although the other one was still very breakable too, right? You know, they've all been breakable depending on how you hold it. I always have a case because I like to keep the value of my phone when every 2 years it's time to get a new one. Usually, you always get that itch to upgrade. Get a case because you can get a lot of money for your phone. In fact, today, I would say, if you're thinking about even just on the fence about upgrading, you should lock in a selling price today because you can make the most money today by selling your iPhone rather than waiting till after the iPhone's announced.
All right, but Bill and I both have the iPhone 6S. Jasmine, do you have a 6S or are you above that?
I have a 7.
You Richie. is it even, like, who's going to buy our 6s?
There are a lot of places that will just give you cash for trading it in. If you go to the Apple Store, you guys have the 6S's. You'll get $100 on the spot as long as your screen isn't totally cracked. If it's cracked, you'll still get some money for it, maybe like $50 or something. But yeah, you can get $100. There are websites, a lot of them out there. In fact, it's a little confusing how many there are. They'll accept your trade-in of your phone because they're going to go off and sell it. And I've seen prices that for the 6S, you can get about $120 on a site called Declutter. There's a site called Glide with a Y instead of an I. Then you get $180. Really, if you want to put the effort in, eBay is your best bet. You can get maybe about $160 or $170 right now on eBay.
Is that because it has the headphone jack? Because 7 and above, they removed that jack.
I know, and I think maybe the 6S might be a little more or easier to sell for people who want to hold on to that stuff, right? But even the 7, Jasmine, that's going for $200 now. You don't have to do much. All you got to do is just say, okay, you know, lock in a price now online. They'll give you a month to decide if you even want to mail it in, so there's no requirement from you. If you go to a site like Declutter or Buyback World, you might have heard of a thing called Gazelle. They were the most popular, although I think they offer the worst. Gazelle was only giving $60 for an iPhone 6S. But nevertheless, there's a lot of competition out there. You lock in a price today. You have a month to decide if you want to mail it in. And when you do, they inspect it, make sure it's not totally busted, and then you get a check in the mail. I've done it before, and it's pretty easy. Or you just go in person to Best Buy or go to the Apple Store. You know, a lot of stores take it back. Even GameStop, the video games place, they'll even take your phone. So it's almost like, hey, if you're going to go buy a new phone, even AT&T, Verizon, they'll give you cash for it. But not everyone gives the same amount of cash, you know. So you got to weigh, all right, what's more convenient for you, what's less hassle, and how much money you want to make. If you want to make the most money, you got to do it yourself on eBay, I would say. But, of course, it's more hassle.
Bridget, I watch a lot of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, and I'm thinking of switching to only burner phones. Is that a good idea for me?
Yeah, a flip burner phone. I think it'll be really trendy.
All right,
here's where I'm confused, Bridget, because I'm just signing into my account right now because I still pay monthly on my phone, so I obviously owe money on it. Uh-huh. So if I sell it, what happens? That's where I'm confused.
Okay. That's what happened to me. All right, so I'm talking about locking in a price now, and the reason I was saying that is because as soon as the new iPhone's announced, you might not get $100 for that phone. You might get less. You know, the price they'll offer on some sites drops. But, yeah, let's say you stole money on it. You have to call your carrier. You have to cancel the service. You have to pay off that phone. And for me, when I did it, I was selling my iPhone 7, and that ended up, the money I got for that ended up being the same amount I still owed. So I broke even. So you do have to, like, I called AT&T, you know, they gave me, you know, here's how much you owe still on your phone. Okay. They gave me one lump sum. I had to pay it all off at once. It was like $200 left. And then I got $200 for the phone, but from the other check. So it kind of broke even. But yeah, you have to take all that into consideration and how damaged the phone is, right? Because if you say it's flawless, and they get it inspected and go, oh, this really isn't flawless, you know, they'll give you a little less than you know, because you can't, obviously, anyone can lie about that on the internet. They have to validate it when they get it in person.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never had trouble, though, and my phones have never had cracks, but, you know, I keep them in a case, and they've been pretty decent. I always get the price I'm quoted.
Are you going to do it?
I'm going to sell my contact list.
You don't have anybody in there.
I have five people on there, Wendy. $20. Sell it right now.
All right. So the 10 came out, correct? The iPhone 10. And now what's this new one going to be called? Or new 3?
Yeah. The names are, they look confusing on paper because they call the 10 the Roman numeral with the X. So this one might be the 10S, which would look like XS. And then there could be the 10 Plus, which will be a larger version, maybe even have a more souped-up camera in the back. And then there'll be a cheaper model called the 10C. It'll look like XC.
For cheap? C for cheap?
I know. Like I wonder what that C stands for, right? But what it'll be is... the screen will be maybe a lesser quality, like they'll say LCD versus OLED. Like most people really don't notice that stuff. And it'll come in maybe some brighter colors or different color options. But, you know, that you just, you have a Goldilocks situation, you know, whatever one's best fit for you, I suppose.
Yeah. All right.
And is it the Samsung Note that's getting all the press too? It's what's weird to me is these phones are getting bigger and bigger. Pretty soon they're going to be the size of an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them will fit in our women jeans ever. Like, I feel like here comes technology supposed to make your life easier. But wait a second, now you need a wireless headset, and it doesn't fit in your pants. And oh yeah, I'm paying more money than I ever had before for Facebook. You know? So yeah, I know it doesn't come cheap, but yeah, Samsung is the one that's really competing here against them, and of course they're throwing some teases out to say, hey, watch for us in November, we're going to have a folding phone. So okay, I guess they're going to throw something at us in a couple of weeks too. That might you know change the way we think about smartphones that have screens that can fold in half. I don't know what they're going to show, but they've been talking a big game.
Technology, you gotta love it. Bridget, thank you so much. You're going to the event tomorrow. Will you be covering it for CNET?
I will be watching along. They stream it from, although it happens in San Francisco, they stream it. So I'll be following along from my comfy laptop.
The way to do it, Bridget. Nicely done.
Excellent. Thank you. You can find her at CNET.com, on Twitter, at Bridget Carey. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, Bill, I got to tell you, coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. It's all happening right here, WGN Radio.
Steve, thanks. I'm Bill, that's Wendy. You're listening. If you want to contribute, if you want to jump in with a question or a comment, 312-981-7200. Are you in the mood for
love?
Are you in the mood for love?
Simply because you're near me, dear.
That's not what I was going to say. I was going to say that. Here's what I was going to say, although your option is also a fun one. You want to hear something really, really, really creepy?
Yes.
Yeah? All right. I got something then. On Saturday, Terry, my wife.
Your lovely wife.
Said, you got to see what's in the yard. And I go, all right, I'll see what's in the yard. And then we went to the window and we saw a very large raccoon in our yard behaving strangely.
Rabies.
Well, that's one of the ideas that we came up with.
I love the two of you.
We put our heads together. Now, neither of us are zoologists, Wendy, but we recognize...
Could you identify usual raccoon behavior?
I like to think that a raccoon doing normal stuff is, at that time of the day, because this was in the morning.
They're nocturnal.
They're off sleeping.
So
right?
Your first clue something's wrong is they're
right.
Active.
So it's moving around the yard almost
looking for you.
Covert. that was another idea. That's what my wife said. You got to go out there and get rid of that raccoon because it's he's looking
for you. He's coming for you. She throws you out there.
It was moving in a way that I don't think raccoons would normally move in, which supports Steve's theory of rabies.
And was it my theory?
It was mine, but
was
that's
that your
okay.
theory?
No one listens to me.
I can't tell the difference between you guys. I don't know who's who.
It's, I'm the nice one.
And I look like James Spader.
Its tail was wagging nonstop.
I was happy to see you.
Oh, no, it didn't know. We were safe inside our home watching it through a window, but it was like crawling around, and then it would kind of try to stand upright for a while and then crawl around.
Poison.
Tail was wagging like crazy. So it did this in our yard for a while, and then I said, I don't want that raccoon to do that in our yard. I wish it would go somewhere else. And it did. Very soon after, it went into my neighbor's yard, and it did the same thing in my neighbor's yard for a little bit, but it didn't like their yard as much, so it came back and kept doing it in our yard. So I did what I do best.
Call police?
I ran away. I said to my wife, this is on you. I will be elsewhere. She called Animal Control, and of Evanston Animal Control, and was promptly told that they're not in on weekends, which is very distressful to me.
Cutbacks, man.
Right.
I guess cutbacks, but if I was running Animal Control, I would say we should be there on weekends.
That's when animals are more active.
I think so.
They don't have to work.
It's the weekend. They have nothing but time.
We went out last weekend and we're like animals.
Right. You hear that phrase all the time. Animal Control, get with the times. You got to be there Saturday and Sunday. Take Monday off. Tuesday's a slow day. Sometime.
Sunday I could see, but this was a Saturday?
This was Saturday morning.
So this happened to me several years ago. We had a raccoon in the front yard, and we had a culvert at the time, and it's going in and out and in broad daylight. So I called Animal Control, and I said, right, this means it has rabies, or I'm worried about it. And they're like, nah, don't worry about it. It's
really?
Fine. Yeah.
Oh, well, we were worried. I mean, there's little kids in the neighborhood.
And animals.
And other animals.
We have coyotes in my neighborhood.
I called about a coyote in the middle of the day on someone's front yard, and the police said to me, oh, it's you again. No, they didn't say that.
They said, Jessica Fletcher?
Okay. They said, you know, okay, we'll mark that down. And I said,
it's funny,
what does that mean?
It's like, mark it. So did the coyote right there.
And I said, what do you mean mark it down? And they said, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. There are a lot of coyotes out here. We just mark down when there's a report of one, and then we report it to Animal Control.
Well, that's not good enough.
I know.
Wait a minute. What can they? That's like reporting a mouse anymore. What can they do about a coyote running through? We had a coyote in my front yard this weekend. I mean, they're now everywhere.
But this
they're
was everywhere. Daytime, and again, a mangy looking coat.
I know, but that's
something
what they
wrong.
Are. No, that's how they look, and they're out during the day. Really.
All right, but a generation ago, because I remember this vividly, when I was a kid, if you called Animal Control, they sent guys over. They sent a team of guys over with like dart guns or pellet guns or something. And if an animal seemed like it was endangering anybody.
In distress. They'd take care of
it. They would take care of business.
Remember the name Pete Pahalik?
No.
He was the longtime city director of Animal Control. I mean, for decades.
In Chicago?
Yeah, and you'd call Pete.
And he'd come by himself.
Or he'd send someone. Yeah, hey, Pete, we're getting calls about a raccoon on Narragansett. Oh, send the people over.
Well, when a police officer, because my wife then called the police, because Animal Control had the Gone Fishing sign on their office. So my wife calls the police, and a man named Officer Kevin came over. And he, because at this point, the raccoon, we've got this little area under our patio, and it found its way in there. So he took a broom and was convincing the raccoon to not be under there, you know? So this behavior continued throughout the day on Saturday.
Excitement at the Leff household.
On Sunday, my wife wakes me up and says, the raccoon problem has both intensified and stopped. And I said, I don't know how that's possible because those are the opposites.
I think Wendy got it early on. Go ahead.
The raccoon died in our yard. And it's carcoon carcass. It's raccoon carcass. There's no such word as carcoon carcass.
I like it. Saturday morning carcoons.
Yeah. Whee! The raccoon carcass was just laying out there.
Were his feet up, and did he have X's for eyes?
No, but it looked like he was peacefully napping. And that's what I said to my wife. The last thing we want to do is bother it. But I was told that it's my job to remove the body.
Well, yes.
So yeah. Wendy, when Wendy said it was probably poison, I bet she was right, and that's why I was behaving so strangely.
Oh, erratically, yeah.
Maybe. Maybe. So then I...
What'd you do?
Well, it's
Can
not
Can we
still
take
there.
A break?
Yes. Take a break. Yes.
First, they went to the hazmat store.
Well, I was afraid. It's so ridiculous.
Did you poke it with a stick?
No, I didn't poke.
The broom?
I said to Terry, we have to wait 6 hours.
Why 6 hours?
Because if it was napping.
It's a raccoon. Right. He wasn't playing possum. It's a raccoon.
Wikipedia says raccoons never sleep more than 7 hours.
Right. We looked it up. First of all, did you ever see Pet Sematary?
Yes.
All right. In my head, Pet Sematary kept playing. It's like, it looks like it's dead, but then once I try to remove it, maybe it's not so dead anymore. And then I'm dead. I don't want that.
It wouldn't have killed you.
I don't want that at all. All right, I'll explain what happened next. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day, his woman ran off with another guy, hit young Rocket in the eye.
Oh, Rocket didn't like that.
He said, did you name this raccoon? Or
no.
Raccoon, as some people call it?
I didn't name it at all. It was, first of all, it scared my family on
Saturday.
It scared
you and Terry.
It scared me. Everybody else was fine. I was the one that was scared. The raccoon died somewhere in the middle of the night between
Poor
Saturday
thing.
And Sunday.
All alone, like a raccoon.
Yeah, well, it was a raccoon, so yeah. But then it was explained to me that it is my job to get rid of the raccoon.
As the man of the house.
Yeah, that was explained to me. And then I explained back that I was a scared, that I couldn't... Wendy,
it's pretty big, too.
Seriously.
I know.
Really big and thick and like... I would put it at somewhere between the 10 to 12 pound range.
Bigger than a baby bunny or something like, or a squirrel.
Well, we did a thing where we took a garbage can, a small garbage can, our recycling bin actually, but it's decent sized, you know, and we triple bagged it.
Oh, okay.
And then the plan was to lift the raccoon up with a shovel,
yeah,
and deposit it in.
It's a good way to do
and
it.
And tie it up. But I somehow physically couldn't bring myself to.
Were you retching?
To shovel it. Yeah, I was sick. I was sick to my stomach. My wife did it. I stood nearby and said, a little more to the left, a little more to the right. Now drop it. Put it in the bucket now. And then I tied it up. But we both wore like these ridiculous latex gloves because rabies couldn't possibly
permeate.
And just
germs.
Yeah, there's germs and stuff. My wife threw out everything that came near the raccoon has now been disposed of.
Except the shovel.
Oh, that's right. We kept the shovel.
Just hose it down.
We kept the shovel. Several people have told me, by way of text, Wendy, that is a raccoon that had distemper. Distemper.
Yeah. Well, it could be many of the...
219. We had a raccoon just like that. It had distemper. Very dangerous. Police came. They tried to capture it. It was fatally shot. And then the word yikes, which I would have also said yikes.
That's a waste of a bullet.
Well... Is it, though? I mean, if and I don't know the difference. What is the difference between distemper and rabies? Is it dramatic? I don't know the difference.
Yes, one is bad. Rabies is worse. And someone's suggesting you should have called the animal control Monday morning and said, come take this and test it for rabies.
Oh, that's a good idea.
What'd you do, throw it in the garbage?
Yeah, it's in the garbage.
You know, I don't know what it is with you guys, but our old dog Tiki used to get rabbits very frequently, and Jim would come out there with a shovel, and he would do it very reluctantly, but, you know, you'd get out a plastic Mariano's or Jewel bag, and you'd get the shovel, yeah. And he'd be gagging the whole time.
I was like that. I did a squirrel a year and a half ago. I disposed of a squirrel, Wendy. Come on.
Men are desperate.
We've all had desperate times, but that's ridiculous, please. So I have disposed of a squirrel in the past, and it's not, I don't
it's
know what
queasy.
It is.
It's
yeah,
bad.
You're picking up something that was, you know, once had life in it.
It's sad.
Now, yeah, it is.
And uncomfortable and very creepy and weird.
It's all those things.
And
my
Kona,
wife had to do it. I couldn't do it.
Yesterday, Kona, we have... little baby bunnies that are, the mom is really stupid because she makes the nest right in the center of the yard. And we have a dog. You'd think they would smell. And so Kona had something in his mouth and he was treating it very gently and gingerly. So I yelled to Jim, Kona got a bunny. And Jim comes rushing outside. He slams open the screen door and he goes, I'm not good with this stuff. It was sort of like George Costanza was living with me. I'm not good with this.
I don't know why.
It turned out to be a rock.
Oh, well, that's easy.
Yeah.
That's easy enough.
I handled that one.
Yeah.
But the dead animals, it's really, and the worst thing is, Bill, is if they're not dead yet. Like if your dog gets a rabbit and it's not.
I don't know. What would you do under those circumstances? You finish it off? You got to finish
it
off.
I can't. I'm not that type of person. And I know it's terrible. I had a neighbor who would drop a brick on it. He wasn't home.
That's awful.
Yeah, but you don't want it to suffer. But I can't do that.
When I was doing stand-up once, a girl I was working with accidentally hit a dog, and she was a big dog lover, but she was right across from the club, and she hit a dog and didn't kill the dog, just hit it, and the dog was, you know, whimpering around and trying to, and she said to me, can you go and finish the dog? And I go, no, I can't do that.
She asked the total wrong person.
I can't do that. You have to do. You started it. You finish it. I can't do that.
But if it was a dog, I would probably try. I would call the police and say, "Can you transport it to a vet?" Or maybe I would take it and bring it to the.
According to her, and like I said, a huge, huge dog lover, this dog was beyond repair. That it needed to be finished off, and I can't do that.
You know, she must not be a good friend because you don't ask a friend to finish off the job.
Right. You get a fixer. You get like a Harvey Keitel to do that. A fixer guy to finish him off.
Hey, entrepreneurial idea for someone out there.
That's a good business idea.
Because everybody, no one wants to finish the job. So if
put
you can
put that
be
on Shark Tank.
No.
Wouldn't that be great on Shark Tank?
No, it wouldn't.
Hey, sharks, I got a business venture that nobody's ever tried before.
But it's a necessary job.
Ex-pet. I got a job. It's called ex-pet. That would never work. I don't think that would work at all. But now I'm afraid because anytime I've seen raccoons in or around our yard, it's always a family of them. So did they witness any of what went on? Did these raccoons see my wife and I put their friend in a bag?
Well, you didn't kill it.
I know, but I can't. How do you explain that to a family of raccoons? A series of diagrams, crudely drawn diagrams?
I don't know. And someone says, I don't mean to be rude, but can you try not to say hitting animals with shovels? It's sad. We didn't hit animals with shovels. We used
the
shovels.
To.
We are not killers.
No.
We need someone to step up and be the fixer.
Right.
The animal fixer.
Right. I've never in my life come so close to calling Steve Dale. I came within an inch of calling Steve Dale to go, Steve, you love animals. Come fix this. Make this right again.
He's more cats and dogs and what's that thing he has, that skink?
A skink.
I think it's he just a lizard.
Says, I think he says skunk wrong between you and me. I just think
it's
he pronounces
a funny accent
he pronounces
has.
Skunk way incorrectly. I don't
I have a skink. Does your skink bite?
I know. I don't want to make fun because he's a nice man, but I think his pronunciation on skunk is way off target, in my opinion. But then, like I said to Terry, after the deed was done, after the raccoon was disposed of, I said, I want to take 3 showers in a row now. I didn't physically touch the raccoon, but just knowing that it, because it had something, you wouldn't behave like that if you didn't have something going on, right? It was just behaving very peculiar, strangely.
It either, you know, got into some poison or it was rabid or distemper, as someone said. But I mean, at that point, what do you do?
Right, right.
You don't rehab it.
I wonder if it fell out of the tree.
I saw a squirrel that was, I've never seen a squirrel fall. Have you? I mean, you see them walk.
I have seen squirrels fall.
I never have. They walk on the tightrope of the electrical wires. You see them way up in a tree. And the other day I was walking the dog and I looked down and there was a dead squirrel that I was tipped off to by another dog owner who said, watch out for the dead squirrel. And I looked and it was just laying on its side on an oak leaf with a bunch of acorns around it. And I thought, oh my God, that's a way to go.
Yeah.
He was going to get that last acorn. But that's the first. I've never seen a squirrel fall out of a tree or get electrocuted.
I've never seen them get electrocuted, but I've seen them fall twice. And when they fall, they look very embarrassed, as if to say, if your other squirrel's watching this, I know that we're not usually supposed to fall, but I did. So they look around like, no one saw that, right? They just have that look.
The Chevy Chase of squirrels.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll get you some news, and then there's more show ahead. It's Bill Leff, and it's Wendy Snyder on WGN.
In a white room with black curtains.
Thank you, Kim. We have something to give away. It's I hope there's a white room at White Pines Resort. We have a $50 dinner certificate to give away to White Pines Resort. It's just 90 minutes west of Chicago. It's in the White Pines Forest State Park in beautiful Oregon, Illinois. They have delicious home-style cuisine, generous portions, and in the resort's restaurants, there is live entertainment in the dinner theater featuring singers, comedians, musicians, and why don't you book a stay while you get the $50 dinner certificate at whitepinesresort.net. We're going to give these away all week, and then Friday we're actually giving away an overnight cabin stay.
That's pretty nice.
At White Pines Resort.
You, Wendy, yesterday mentioned that you believe you may have stayed there as a child. You're not positive.
I don't remember much from my childhood, but I know there was one video of all the Snyders wearing red gym shoes, except for my dad, who was videotaping it.
Yes.
Red Keds.
Oh.
We were the red-headed
family. Was there a sale at Tom McCann
Maybe.
Or something?
I think that was White Pines. Yeah. I remember Stepping Stones and Log Cabins, so I'm pretty sure that was
it. Them.
So what number caller? 312-981-7200, $50 dinner certificate to White Pines Resort.
How old do you think you were when you were at White Pines?
Eight.
Caller eight.
312-981-7200. We'll set you up with a $50 dinner certificate. And like I said, we're doing this all week with the dinners. And then on Friday, we're going to give away an overnight cabin stay at White Pines. To find out more, go to whitepinesresort.net.
I want this memory to be more clear for you. Do you remember driving a long way to get there?
No, I don't. I just remember.
Remember that?
I remember
was Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck there?
No.
Oh, it wasn't Disneyland.
No. I remember Stepping Stones and a Babbling Brook. And then I remember seeing family footage of the red gym shoes, but that could be somewhere else.
Yeah.
I remember the Babbling Brook.
Yeah.
Maybe that was my neighbor. Babbling
was that
Brook.
Her?
Yeah.
Did she just keep talking the whole time you guys were buying your
red
shoes?
That's where I got it from.
Oh, all right. All right. That makes sense.
All right, we have a winner, and we were Pete from Wonder Lake, going from Wonder Lake to White Pines Forest State Park. That's a man of adventure.
That's quite a trip.
So congratulations.
Yes. Do you remember on Friday, now we're going back a couple of days, Wendy.
I don't remember
yesterday. You don't remember any of this. Tim Cavanaugh, our friend Tim Cavanaugh, was on the show. Comedian extraordinaire. Did
Sorry.
You just break your nose on the microphone?
Yes, are you all right? I did. I'm fine.
All right. So Tim Cavanaugh was on. And, well, here's a surprise. The same Tim Cavanaugh that I'm telling you about happens to be on the phone line right now. Tim, is what I said true? You were on our show on Friday, right?
I was on your amazing show on Friday. And what a powerful, powerful show you have.
Yeah.
Because my life is changing really, really quickly based on what happened on Friday on your show.
Well, what happened on Friday? You put a shout-out to someone.
I did. You know, I came on the show, and I mentioned Brett Kavanaugh, who's of course, up for the Supreme Court nomination.
Yes.
And I happen to have the same last name, Kavanaugh.
Spelled differently.
And I'm not related to Brett Kavanaugh. But I mentioned that there's another prominent attorney here in town by the name of Tim Cavanaugh, the exact same name that I have. And this guy is really, he's really good. And he's gotten like huge settlements. Like he did a $20 million settlement from the Chicago City Council.
Yeah.
Over the Code of Silence case. So he's like, he's a big deal and he's very, very, very successful.
But not as successful as you because you out-Googled him, correct?
That was exactly the point that I wanted to make to him. If he had been listening, which I didn't expect that he was, but hang on. All this right. is exciting.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you Google Tim Cavanaugh, If you do it right now, I just did it. The top 10 responses are, 8 of them are me, and 2 of them are him.
That's close.
You know, horn tutor.
So that's costing him business.
I would think.
I mean, I am in his way. I am blocking a lot of people from coming to his site.
Yeah.
So I made an offer that this is a bona fide offer that I would change my name for $3 million. So all that the other Tim Kavanaugh would have to do is pay me $3 million. I would change my name. I would disappear from all those search engines, and he would be able to rule the internet the way that he should.
Right. It seems like
so,
a fair offer. $3 million.
I didn't think I'd hear anything.
Yeah.
$3 million. $3 million. Which, you know, given how successful he is, I thought, okay, that's good.
Probably has
actually,
it in his
I've
wallet.
Written more about him, and I'm. You know what? I'm thinking of maybe going up to 4. Because, you know, he's good. Anyway, I didn't expect to hear anything for a while because I figured, you know, he's going to take his time thinking about this.
Be honest, you didn't expect to hear anything at all.
No, I didn't. But that's why I was surprised. Sunday morning, this is less than 48 hours after my appearance on your show. I got a call from a woman at the Kavanaugh Law Group.
Mm-hmm.
That Tim Kavanaugh is not going to get on the line himself. He's
right.
Going to have, you know, some of his people.
Yeah.
And let me just say, her name was Nancy, and that wasn't her real name. I don't want to give her real name because we are in the middle of some very delicate negotiations, so I have to be very careful.
Sure.
What I say.
Yeah.
On the air.
Yeah.
Okay, but this woman wanted me to know that Tim Kavanaugh, the lawyer, is considering my offer.
Oh.
And I wanted a little bit of time on the show this morning.
Yeah.
Just to tell them that the timing of this thing could not be better because I'm currently on a Carnival cruise ship, and we are docking tomorrow in Grand Cayman.
Nice. Very nice.
Now, would that be... I think the timing of this is just, like, perfect, because I could just get off the ship, open an account.
Yes.
Tim Kavanaugh could wire me the $4
million. $3 million, Tim. It's $3
million. You know what?
What's a million?
I'm thinking,
right.
You know,
let's say $4 million.
You know, he's really shown his hand here,
right?
And I hate to play hardball with the guy, because he seems like a very, very nice man. But you know, I mean, it was 2 days,
yeah.
And he could not cool his jets.
He wants to act fast.
He's eager to.
Well,
he's eager to get this thing done.
Are you aware of this Facebook message that he left?
No.
Seriously? That's why we're having you on. Tim Kavanaugh.
Well, his person left a Facebook message for me. And that Facebook message. Okay. You know what? Just to kind of make me feel better and put me in a better mood and try to get me to negotiate a little bit nicer, what he did is I was doing a fundraiser on Sunday for the St. Vincent de Paul Society. So what he did, very shrewd, he donated $1,000.
Right. Can I just read this message? It said, Tim Kavanaugh, you drive a hard bargain. I'm still considering $3 million to change your name. Maybe we can negotiate that at some point, smiley face. But I would like to donate $1,000 to the St. Vincent de Paul Society Southside Neighbors in Need fundraiser today on behalf of the Kavanaugh Law Group.
That's so nice.
It says we hope the fundraiser is a huge success. So look, you got a donation. I don't think you're getting the $3 million or $4 million.
You know what? I want to sincerely thank the Kavanaugh Law Group and Tim Kavanaugh. We had a great time at the benefit on Sunday at Bourbon Street. We had a nice crowd. We raised some money, and believe me, the $1,000 that was donated by the Kavanaugh Law Group, by Tim Kavanaugh himself, is awesome.
Yeah.
And I am so grateful, and I'm so thankful. And, you know what? I'm so grateful. You know what? Forget the $4 million. it's back to $3
million. It's three million.
And you're performing on the Carnival cruise ship. I don't know what you say in that case. Break an oar? What should we say to you?
Yeah, that would be good. Don't go overboard. would be something. Do I have time to say one more thing?
You can say
because
one more thing.
You asked me on Friday what I was going to change my name to.
Yes.
And I gave it a lot of thought. I'm going to change my name to, if he pays me this $3 million, to Julio Chen.
Julio Chen.
Because I'm a big fan of Julie Chen.
Me as well.
Have been for a long, long time. You know, she was married to Maury Povich.
Yes.
And so I decided to, you know,
no,
I can't
she
go
wasn't.
With Julie Chen.
She's married to Les Moonves.
You're thinking of Connie Chung.
Jeez. Oh,
I think we have a bad connection.
Bad connection, Tim. We have to run.
Okay, can I change my name to Conrad Chung?
No, you already picked Julio Chen. You can't change it. Once you're in.
Shoot.
Yeah, it's too late. That's Tim Cavanaugh, everybody.
I hate myself.
No, please.
Why, I can't.
No, Tim.
I'm
keep,
so stupid.
Keep us posted.
That up.
Keep us posted, please. Let us
and
know what happens with you and the other Tim Cavanaugh. Stay on board. That's Tim Cavanaugh, everybody. Thanks, Tim. The former Tim Cavanaugh, now Julio Chen. You can see him down by the schoolyard. We'll take a quick break and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Yes, that Bill O'Reilly has a new book coming out next month, and he'll be joining the Steve Cochran Show tomorrow morning at 7:10 to talk all about it. Tune in for that.
Earlier in the show, for most of the first hour of the show, we discussed this being the anniversary of the attacks from September 11th from 17 years ago. Several people have texted in, both then and still now, saying that even though they were very young when it happened, most of them grade school age, they have very vivid memories of the events that took place that day. We were trying to figure out, I can't remember, Steve had used a number, Steve Bertrand had used a number and said that if you were of this age, it's a faint, distant memory of
September 11th. He said 30 and under, but
I don't know.
Probably 20. I guess 30 and under. Your girls remember it, but they were only four.
They have very broken up memories of it. Nothing really specific, because they were 4 years old. We were kind of stranded. We were on vacation in Florida, and because you couldn't take a flight, I had to get back to work a few days later. So we ended up, I called a rental car place and said, look, my intention is I got to drive a car from here to Chicago. I don't have any other choice. And they said, we've got a lot of people with similar circumstances. By all means, take the car where you need to take it.
I bet you had reservations about getting on a plane, too.
Well, when I came back, I flew the first day that air flights were allowable again. And it was a very nerve-wracking day at the airport. There was security everywhere. Marshals were on the plane without any question. There were two guys on the plane who you knew were air marshals. That was it. And it was like that for, I don't remember if it was for a couple of weeks or a month, but I flew a couple times within the next month, and their presence was very widely known, and I was fine with that.
Yeah, of course.
I wanted that. But what a strange, I mean, everything about it was just so strange and so foreign. And I just remember there being so much indecision as to what would happen next, you know?
Well, that's just what was so scary, is you didn't know. And I'll be honest with you, I was afraid for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, waking the sleeping giant that kept being used, and it's just something that was not expected at all. I mean, it was just so shocking. And I was afraid about traveling and going to big cities. And then I felt bad for New York. And then the people of New York, were they worried it was going to happen there again? But then lightning doesn't strike twice in the same spot. It was just, there were so many unanswered questions.
I remember, even though we were on what was supposed to be a vacation and was a vacation up until, you know, that morning, I couldn't leave the television. I think I watched 48 hours straight. I slept an hour here and an hour there, but I couldn't stop watching CNN and MSNBC and all the cable networks. And I'll never forget, at one point in the middle of one of the nights, they had a panel that consisted of a priest, a rabbi, and a minister of some other denomination. It sounds like a joke. It's anytime you saw those three guys, they were always going into a bar. But this particular day, they were sitting on a panel, and all three of them were in agreement that we needed to strike and strike fast, that we needed to find out what part of the world this came from, and we needed to go in and wreck it. And I kept thinking, wow, this is what the world has quickly become. We're three men of the cloth saying, we can't think about it. We just got to act right now.
Revenge.
Because that was how, that, so many people, that was the thought process right now. Find out who we think it came from and hit them back.
And I don't want to end today's show without mentioning Todd Beamer, because I really think of him often.
Yeah.
Flight 93, he was a passenger aboard United Flight 93. And 9:45, Beamer placed a call to an operator at a Verizon Airphone call center in Chicago, relayed that the airplane bound for San Francisco had been hijacked. The operator turned the call over to a supervisor on duty. Beamer was calm as he detailed how three men had taken over the flight. Two had knives, had locked themselves in the cockpit, and one had a bomb strapped to his waist. He told the supervisor about his children and his wife, Lisa, and he said the Lord's Prayer happened, the plane took another dive, and Todd said they had a plan, and the next thing he said, "Are you ready? Okay, let's roll."
Yeah.
And I will never forget that.
Yep.
So let's roll, and we continue to roll.
We'll take a quick break. We'll introduce Steve and tell you what he has coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
And coming up, the stories that matter with Kim Gordon from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.